Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
What if there was a way to level up your energy, get rid of stress, and take more control of your body? Welcome to Quantum Upgrade. This is a new technology that taps into quantum energy to help you feel amazing. Quantum Upgrade has a lot of different products that help protect you from EMF and help activate your body's natural healing abilities. You can expect better sleep, more resilience, less stress, and better blood flow. The cool thing about Quantum Upgrade is that the products are backed by a lot of heavy-duty scientific studies, and there's a new measurable upgrade. You can now use Quantum Upgrade to increase your consciousness levels between 1400 and 2200 on the Hawkins map of consciousness. If you don't know what that means, do some research because it's impressive, it's fun to learn about, and it's something that I've come to understand. Ready to try Quantum Upgrade? Visit quantumupgrade.io/Dave for a 7-day free trial. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is that researchers in the UK measured the testosterone and cortisol levels of 17 young male stock traders to see how they linked to behavior. And what they found was a positive connection between testosterone and profits. But cortisol, the stress hormone, shot up not because of losses, but because of the anticipation of market volatility and the possibility of bigger profits. So basically, these stock traders were tweaked all the time, as far as I could tell.
What if there was a way to feel younger for longer? Well, there is. Your body needs something called the NAD plus molecule to help you age well. When you're young, your body makes a lot of NAD plus, and that helps you make energy, it helps you keep your DNA healthy, absorb nutrients well, and it protects your cells from stress. But once you hit about 30, your NAD plus levels start to drop. The good news is that longevity scientists have found some things that can help, like niacin, niacinamide, and Niagen. They help your body make more NAD+, even as you age. All three of these are in an amazing formula called Qualia NAD+. Check out Qualia NAD+, risk-free, for up to 100 days at neurohacker.com/Dave15 to save an extra 15%. That's neurohacker.com/Dave15, Qualia NAD+. It's what I use.
Today's guest is a friend and an amazingly cool guy. I met him over dinner when I had no idea what he did. And he walked up and gave me this big hug. And I'm like, wow, this guy's like a major hugger here. And it wasn't just like a little hug. It was like, it was a big hug. And I said, well, why do you do that? And he's like, oh, it's good for you. It's pretty vague about it because he wasn't allowed to tell me what he did for a living at this dinner. It was a cool dinner called an influencer dinner put on by another friend, Jonathan Levy. And he puts together these dinners where there's all these influential people in a room and you don't know what they do. So I met Paul Zak there, and Paul was sitting there hugging, and I didn't know that he's basically known as Dr. Love for being the primary force behind the discovery of oxytocin and what it does for us. And it turns out hugging makes a huge difference for you, and it raises oxytocin. You might have seen Paul's talk called The Moral Molecule that had 1 million views as a TED talk. He wrote a book in 2012 called The Moral Molecule. He wrote a book called Moral Markets in 2008, looking at our values. And one of the more interesting guys I've met in the last year, because Paul has degrees in math and economics and neuroimaging from Harvard. So you don't see a lot of people who are professors of neurology and professors of economics and psychology and management at big universities. So Paul's basically a total badass, pulling together all these disparate things and absolutely fun to hang out with. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. That was the nicest intro I've ever had in my life. So now I'm in your hands. I'll do anything. You've got me.
Awesome. Well, it was all authentic and real because meeting you in person was really cool. I, of course, didn't recognize you when we met, but I was familiar with some of your work. I'm like, wow, I just got to have dinner with Paul Zak. This is so cool. And there were some other like movie celebrity people, but I didn't know who they were either. But you were way more interesting, so I don't know. Just kidding.
I feel the same way about you. I mean, we're kind of innovators and inventors, right? So we kind of cling to each other because we get what the other person is doing.
Yeah.
So, it was such a great dinner.
It really was. And the other guy, everyone there was really fascinating. But the guy from Mythbusters was there too. He was pretty interesting chat.
Adam Savage, yeah.
Yeah. So let's get going. Your new book, is it okay if I talk about your new book?
Sure.
All right, cool. I know you're in the middle of editing your book. I'm in the middle of editing my book, but you never know like when they're going to come out. Yours comes out in January, I think. And I want to read it. In fact, if I can have an early copy, I want to read it. So then I'll say nice things about it, obviously, assuming it's worth it, but it will be. It's called Maybe. Trust Factor, The Science of Creating High Performance Companies. And I have a personal interest in doing that because that's what I'm doing.
Right.
So when does it come out?
Comes out January 17th, 2017.
Okay.
117, 2017. Hey, that sounds like a nice ring to it.
It does.
Yeah. And, you know, it grew out. You probably know this as an entrepreneur. You know, sometimes people think that we entrepreneurs or scientists, you know, sit in the lab and go, oh, I got a great idea. Actually, what we've done in my lab is try to be externally focused. I have a lot of ideas. Most of them are probably crazy. We try to listen a lot to other people. Yeah. So, as you mentioned, like in my TED talk, I did a lot of work on why we trust strangers, neurologically, environmentally, like what makes us trust strangers? We can't survive alone. So what brain signals tell us why we trust other people and how do we understand what promotes or inhibits those signals? And trust, we've shown, is a kind of economic lubricant. When trust is higher, then people actually engage in more interactions and some of those create wealth. So working on this, working on lots of other things, and then knock on my lab door, some executives came in and said, we think trust is important for our company. Could you help us understand how to create high trust cultures? And as you know, a lot of our work is done with drawing blood and using sensors for the brain. I said, sure, I'll come to your office. I'll take blood from your employees. You know, they turn white. They go, oh, I can't do that. So we developed a way to measure organizational trust without taking blood using a survey and identified the factors neurologically that create trust. Tried this out in a bunch of companies, ran laboratory experiments, and basically found a way to quantify culture and create constant improvements in culture by measuring, intervening, by giving you a structure to understand what kind of cultures are really effective from the organization's perspective, from the employee's perspective. Now coming to work is fun because I'm getting challenged and recognized I'm growing. That's great. And actually, we've shown that high trust cultures improve societies as well. So the triple bottom line, how about that?
So my first thought there is like, how do I sign up Bulletproof to get into this? Because I'm in the middle of culture building. My biggest challenge as an entrepreneur right now is maintaining just the incredibly high standards and just level of integrity that I expect of myself and that I build into the products and to scale that as the company keeps growing to make sure that when people come in, you know, that they have that level of authenticity and integrity and trust, you know, the T word there you're talking about. So that when you hand a job off, you know that they're not going to let customers down because, like, we have in my mind, a degree of fiduciary responsibility for them. So if we bring someone in, we extend trust, and they haven't earned that trust, or they aren't trustworthy, and they do something that I don't know about that doesn't serve our customers to the very best extent that's possible, like there's a violation that happens there. And you're saying you can quantify that in a way to help to predict it.
Yeah, so my view, trust is a strategic asset in an organization. And somehow we think naturally we're going to get some kind of nice, you know, culture. So people create cultures. Cultures are a set of rules or norms that people create. And people will create that wherever they are. It happens naturally. The book actually starts with me in Papua New Guinea. We may have talked about this at dinner. I actually ran an experiment on organizations in the rainforest in Papua New Guinea. Like, let's just start with the Stone Age and see. And what I learned, besides the cool data, was I embedded myself in their culture. All of a sudden, there's this chief with a fifth grade education. He's telling me what to do, and I do it because I live in his organization now, at least for a week I did. So, you know, we are very good organization men and women. We know how to do that. So if culture is a strategic asset, we've got to measure it and manage it. If you don't manage your culture will manage you. So when we get off the line, I'll send you a link. You're going to use this survey with your employees, and you can get a snapshot of where's my culture now. It'll tell you where to intervene to improve things. We have micro learning modules, so you can go in and do these interventions and change habits and really build this relationship between the people at your work. I call this creating the 3 a.m. employee. So offline, you told me you're up all night editing your book. And what I love is that when I wake up at 5:30 and check my email, occasionally, just occasionally, I get an email at 3 a.m. from someone who works for me, and they go, holy crap, you know this thing that we've been struggling with for 3 months? I just figured it out. So they voluntarily, outside of work time, stayed up till 3 in the morning working on something because they loved it, because it was important to the team. And you can't pay someone enough to do that, right? You have to really be engaged with this team and this purpose. Why are we doing this? How are we improving the world? How are we making a dent in the universe?
Very well said. I'm super excited about that. And if there's a link that we can share with everyone listening, and there's a good chance, you know, a million people eventually hear this episode. So if there's a way people can sign up for something like that, I'd love to share it with them, because there's more than a few big entrepreneurs who listen to the show, and probably hundreds of thousands of smaller ones who are just getting to the point where culture is going to matter for them.
Yeah, the link is ofactor.com, ofactor.com. Lots of information, free stuff, sign up for this and that. So
sweet.
When I started doing this, you know, when you start a new project, you always want to make sure you're not deluding yourself, because we can convince ourselves that we're brilliant if we sit in the office for 2 hours or 2 weeks. And so I spent a lot of time embedded in companies and talked to these entrepreneurs, talked to presidents, asked them what their problems were. And I remember interviewing an entrepreneur who had started 27 companies. And I said, you know, of those 27, how much did you think about culture? In half of them, he said, zero.
Wow.
I thought about hiring the right people, generating profit, you know, who my funders were, who my customer is. I never thought about it. And I said, do some of those companies have sucky cultures? Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine. Like, I've been in some very high growth Silicon Valley companies, like employee 300 to 5,000 in 2 years. My organization, I was like a co-founder of, grew to 1,500 people in 2 years. And culture breaks when you do that. And it's one of the things I think the most about at Bulletproof, so we can keep growing and still be like, still do the right thing all the time. I'm shocked that anyone could start that many companies without thinking about culture. Wow.
Yeah. But he's very successful. Yeah. So obviously he knows what he's doing, but there's a margin there. And particularly for the coming war for talent, you know this. Man, I want to get the best people and keep the best people. And culture is a way that you can do that. You know, from Silicon Valley experience, that it's not just perks and free food. It's really building this relationship, like a Google, right? It's not about the food necessarily. Yeah. Part of it's saving time, but part of it is these big long tables. And you sit next to a bunch of engineers. You never met these guys before. You start having a conversation. Interesting things occasionally happen, and that's really important.
What happens with distributed teams? I'm running into that a lot now. My team's all over the place, and some of them are at our headquarters in Seattle, and the rest of them are kind of all over. What does Skype and video conferencing do to oxytocin and do to trust in companies and things like that? What's your take on that as a guy who has to have studied that?
Great science question. Right. So we've actually run experiments where we've looked at in-person communication compared to, say, video, Skype like we're doing now, text. And it turns out that we are such social creatures that whatever kind of communication we have stimulates the release of oxytocin, including tweeting. Like when you tweet out, you got peeps out there, right?
Yeah.
Like I felt like I haven't tweeted in 2 days. Oh my gosh, my people need me. Like, so our brain produces oxytocin. We feel connected. So having said that, from research outside my lab, as you know, going to Seattle, seeing the people in person, you know, once a quarter at least, it's really important for some reason. So for the people who work with me, I love the daily huddle. I don't know about you. The 10-minute stand-up, what are you doing today? How's it going? What happened yesterday? What help do you need from me? And that really keeps people on target. And you can certainly do that by Skype as well. So the basic punchline is the higher the bandwidth of the communication, the bigger the connection from a neurologic perspective. So in person, great. Skype, not quite as good. Text, not nearly as good.
Okay, that's way cool. So everyone listening, that matters. Open up your video instead of just talking on the phone or sending a text. And if you're if one of those people who like basically dreams in text messages, you might want to start dreaming in video conferencing. It's better.
There you go. And travel. You still have to travel. Yeah,
a lot of people make that mistake. I can grow my social media empire. I'm like, nah. The way Bulletproof has grown the way it has is I spend 100 plus days a year on the road connecting with people in person because that's the way you make connections.
Right.
Now, you study something called neuroeconomics, which I think most people listening to this probably don't even know what that is. So I want a little bit of your background story because I don't know how to put this in a different way, but you're a weird guy.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I mean, like, and that's a compliment coming from me.
You're weird like me.
Totally. Yeah. So, I mean, you studied pretty advanced math and economics, and then you cut over to neuroimaging and neuroscience. Why? Like, were you dropped on the head as a child? Not really, but like, what motivated this? Because it's fascinating and way cool, but, like, what made you do that?
What the hell, right? A couple things. First of all, I had three sisters and no brothers, and I had a father who was an engineer. So I basically spent most of my childhood, my dad and I in the garage, building stuff. And so, you know, that's just sort of natural for me to build things. But my parents had no money, so I was putting myself through college, and I have a nice advisor who thought, you know, maybe I should think about graduate school, but here's the math classes I got to take to get prepared for economics. And you have to do another field in economics, math, which was, I did a field in biology because I loved neuroscience, took a bunch of neuroscience classes. So I started doing research in biology and neuroscience as an undergraduate because I was poor. There was research money. Professors in mathematical biology had grants, and they would hire me to do research and run simulations and build software and you know, whatever. And so, you know, from the very beginning, just out of sheer poverty and maybe curiosity, I was interested in this. And then did a PhD in economics, very traditional school, University of Pennsylvania, and then lost my advisors. And all of a sudden, you know, I went from being the fair-haired boy to, like, who the hell are you? And so I didn't know what to do. So I went back and started taking more classes and just in the bio department. And no one knew what I was doing, and no one told me it was a stupid thing to do. And then helped start this field called neuroeconomics. Because I'm really interested in what the humans are doing, and I love economics, but the underlying assumptions of economics are insane from a modeling perspective. Infinite knowledge, infinite, you know, brain capacity, infinite amount of time. I mean, what world is that? That's, to me, I'm not interested in what I call imaginary economics. I'm interested in solving problems. So I found that by using findings in behavioral neuroscience to understand how people make decisions, which is what economics is about, I could be a more effective scientist, scholar, problem solver. I think. I hope.
You're reminding me, in 2002, I was getting my MBA at Wharton, but they flew the professors from Pennsylvania out to San Francisco, so I didn't have to actually commute. It would have been a long commute. And I was doing the business grad, whatever, statistics class. And I wanted to do what would now be called neuromarketing because I had an EEG machine. I'd already had it for 5 years. And I wanted to see, what do our brains do when we're looking at ads? And then just use, sure. I just need a random data source to do correlation analysis for it. And no one in my study group seemed to have any clue what I was talking about and just didn't want to do it. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. And it turns out it would have been one of the first neuromarketing papers out there because it didn't have a name. But you took it up a level to neuroeconomics to get rid of all the weird assumptions that are made from, like, 100-year-old economics and Adam Smith and all this stuff, like theories of rational actors, even though we're not rational creatures. How did oxytocin tie into all that, though? Like how did you get from the economic side of thing into oxytocin? That's still not clear in my mind.
Yeah, and I wish it was a great story. You know, no, I was working on a couple projects, one on trust across countries, and was building models, a lot of biology underlying the economic decision. That actually is more explanatory than either of those fields alone. And so we started building these models, and they had an impact. The World Bank flew me out. At the same time, I was working on other factors that I thought economics and biology could inform us on, like how much we invest in our children, what we call human capital. Where does that come from? How much is that genetic? How much is environmental? And I was at going to a conference with a well-known anthropologist named Helen Fisher, who's written a number of books. The Anatomy of Love, I think, is her best-known book. And I was talking to her about my work. This is up in the Sierras in the summer. So, you know, there's a bunch of mountain bikers and then two people in, you know, business casual clothes. You pretty much know they're going to your conference. And blah, blah, blah. She said, have you ever heard of oxytocin? I said, no idea. She started telling me about it. And I go back to my hotel room and I literally missed the dinner. I'm like going on PubMed. I'm like, holy crap, this is the signal I've been looking for to understand why I trust Dave, but I don't trust your engineer, Bob, who's a sketchy guy. I can just tell. Like, our brains have to have some signal that tells us when it's safe to interact, when it's not, when I expect you to be trustworthy, when it's not. And lots of animal literature, zero done in humans for a variety of reasons. There's no medical reason besides preterm labor to think about oxytocin. There are no disorders. So it was just sitting there on the shelf. There was no way to measure it acutely, and I had to work out a protocol to do that. But once you have that measurement tool, you can really go to town.
So when you went to town, you revealed it as a trust hormone or the moral molecule. Why do you call oxytocin the moral molecule?
Great question. So what we found is that, just like in animals, humans, when they encounter another member of their species, or actually other species like dogs and cats do, but anyway, I interact with another human, and I'm getting signals from you unconsciously that say, Dave looks totally safe. My brain produces oxytocin that motivates me to interact with you. So the benefit of interacting is we might become friends or do a project together or hang out or whatever. Or the cost is you might kill me or I don't know, punch
right.
me or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so we're constantly balancing this. And oxytocin moves us towards, hey, interact. There could be value from that. While at the same time, the kind of fear, you know, system says, hey, be a little careful. So when I get a positive interaction from you, my brain creates oxytocin. It increases my sense of empathy. So now I'm more, not only more motivated to interact with you, I'm more emotionally connected to how you're feeling, which makes me a much more effective social creature. Not only can I forecast what you might do cognitively, but now I'm starting to share some of your emotions. So now I get a sense of your feeling state. So when I do that, it turns out I'm going to treat you better. I'm much less likely to treat you badly. I'm more concerned about your welfare in tangible ways. We've run hundreds of experiments measuring oxytocin and actually, as you know, manipulating it pharmacologically so I can shoot it into people's brains. And we can turn on these positive social behaviors like turning on a garden hose.
So I actually tried that. This is probably 4 or 5 years ago. I was testing about 50% low on oxytocin. And don't ask me to remember what lab this came from. This was 5 years ago or so. And I'm like, all right, so I tried sublingual oxytocin, relatively low dose, but I did it for about 60 days. I didn't feel a thing. But I know other people have done oxytocin nasal spray, and they're like, oh my God, it changed my life. Why the difference in oxytocin responsiveness between individual people? And what should you feel like if you took a big hit of, if you snorted a line of oxytocin to create right. a bad analogy there, but...
So yeah, we developed the first oxytocin inhaler for research use. There was one that was around to help women start preterm labor, but we optimized basically that impact. And the nose, so you want to get the stuff into the brain, right? That's where the receptors are primarily. And the nose is a portal to the brain, as you know, because of the immune system, the blood-brain barrier is a little looser there. The gut will break down oxytocin. It's a very simple molecule. So once it gets into the gut, it's gone. It's just broken down. It doesn't get into brain. So it's got to go through the nose. You can get a little into the brain IV, but I don't think you want to be sticking needles in your veins.
I'm okay with that, but
okay. That's another conversation. So we've done. I've tested probably more people on intranasal oxytocin than anybody in the United States.
Wow.
And we've never had one adverse effect. No tummy ache. No headache. Why? Because your brain makes this anyway. Yeah. We are sledgehammering you with the dose because we want to study you, you know, experimentally. No real effect. A little bit of relaxation. People tend to yawn a little more. The receptors for oxytocin near the yawn area in the brainstem. But basically, it kind of melts that self-other divide where all of a sudden, are you my friend, Dave? Or are you my brother, Dave? So give me oxytocin. You're like my brother. Like, I know you. You're a good guy. There's no high associated with it, just this kind of sense of relaxation.
Got it.
Interesting side effects, if I may,
yeah,
may share
please.
Those with you. So about 20% of the men we give oxytocin to... So, sorry, backstory. Nature's a Republican. You're aware of this, right? So, although he's not voting for Donald Trump, I don't think. But nature's conservative because it reused the systems they evolved for one purpose for other purposes.
Yeah.
So oxytocin originally evolved in mammals to facilitate live birth and care for offspring. How do you create live birth? People have to have sex. And so there are receptors for oxytocin in the vagina, in the penis. It's released in loads when you have an orgasm.
Did you really just say that?
Sorry. Bad choice of words.
Keep going.
It's plentiful in the brain while people are enjoying
that. That will be tweeted many times, Paul.
Oh, my God. Sorry. Little Freudian slip. Okay. So about 20% of men we give intranasal oxytocin to will get erections.
Really?
Yeah, because it has to all go in the brain. Some of that goes into the peripheral blood, and it will bind to the receptor. So I always tell the research assistants, you know, we're doing experiments. They're at desks. Don't look below the desk. You're like, you don't want to know what's going on.
Tell them, wear short skirts and see what happens. Got it.
And so some women can lactate when we give them oxytocin. It facilitates milk flow for letdown. It's pretty rare because you have to have high enough estrogen levels. All these things are...
I had no idea these were side effects. I didn't experience either of those, fortunately, from oxytocin. But, okay, now what would happen if we went into a prison environment and we offered nasal oxytocin to everyone? I'm just thinking about an environment where there's lots of trauma and lots of unhappiness. What would happen other than erections?
Yeah, we studied that. So we looked at the developmental effects, again, in this, if you will, Republican brain, my little joke. If you're not in animals, if you're not getting enough nurturing, then the receptors for oxytocin atrophy because you don't need that nurturing system. You're not getting cared for. So we tested that in women who, as children, were severely sexually abused. And indeed, about half of them don't have an intact oxytocin connection system. And they all have, at the same time,
PTSD, basically.
Dysfunctional social relationships, depression, a lot of borderline personalities. And then last summer, we spent a couple weeks at a treatment facility in Wisconsin for criminal psychopaths.
Wow.
And we stimulated oxytocin. We have a little video that will stimulate the brain to make oxytocin. And took blood twice from 161 of these guys. And what we found is no oxytocin release on the stimulus that 90% of the population, it'll spike your oxytocin.
From a video?
Yeah, from a video. We can talk about that in a second. But, you know, what do psychopaths lack? Classically, empathy.
Right.
So I'm a psychopath. I can treat you like a means to an end. I can take your money or I can take your drugs or whatever I want because I don't feel anything for you. But if you or I did that to each other, we feel like, oh, my God, I treated Dave so badly. I feel awful, right? They don't get that. So they don't have that kind of internal moral compass that we do, which seems to be driven by this, what Adam Smith called fellow feeling or empathy.
This is so fascinating. I'm amazed that you went and you did this study on psychopaths. What a fascinating like corner case. So now I understand why it's called the moral molecule for sure. And how does it affect like my individual decision making then? So like if I'm on oxytocin or I just naturally have higher levels or I've been hugging a lot of people or I just had sex or whatever, what is that going to do to me over the over the short term, over the rest of the day, over the rest of the week? Like how does it change me?
Yeah, great question. And the secondary question, the follow-up question is, why don't we just drug everybody with oxytocin?
I was going there. Yeah, just take fluoride out of the water, put oxytocin in, and we'll all be good.
So your brain's production of oxytocin stays active for about 20 minutes, 20, 25 minutes. So I like to say hugs, not drugs. I don't want to drug people. So I stimulate oxytocin in somebody, and for the next 20 minutes, you've kind of narrowed that that divide between yourself and others. And it's interesting. It's a fairly blunt instrument. So we've done studies where a positive interaction with one person or they watch a video causes your brain to make oxytocin. So we measure that, say, in change in blood. And all of a sudden, now you're nicer to other people who aren't even involved in you. So we did studies with massage therapists. So we had people get massages by a professional massage therapist, and then they interacted with a complete stranger who didn't give them a massage. And we use money a lot of times to quantify how much you care about somebody else. And they're sharing money with strangers, you know, easily. They know what they're doing. They're cognitively intact. They just don't care as much. It's like, again, you've melted that self-other divide.
How long is the video?
The video is 100 seconds.
Can I play this at the Bulletproof Conference?
Sure.
Oh, that's so cool. All right.
People will cry, though. I mean, it's a...
Good. That's perfect. Oh, my God. Yeah. That's amazing. Okay, we're so going to give everyone a hit of oxytocin. 3,000 people all in the room at the same time. That is amazing, Paul. All right. Afterwards, I'll hook up with you on this.
Afterwards, we'll do that. And actually, I've stopped, by and large, showing that video in conferences And I'll tell you why. You're in LA right now, is that right?
The conference is in LA. I'm at my farm on Vancouver Island where I live.
Gosh, I'm going to come visit you
there. Oh, anytime, yeah. There's a whole lab here for hacking.
Oh, my God. Okay, we're going to do that. We'll do it sometime this year. So I showed it at a law conference at UCLA, and several lawyers who watched the video actually cried.
I didn't
know.
You are
aware. Lawyers don't have souls.
No, I didn't think they could cry. What the heck? Okay.
Like, okay, I've gone too far. I have to stop. So at least some lawyers actually have oxytocin. How about that? So yeah, it's really effective. It's a little video about a father and his two-year-old son, and the son has terminal brain cancer.
Wow.
And the son's been treated. We got it with permission from St. Jude Children's Hospital. These are not actors. They're real people. The little boy's name is Ben, and he's actually now died. And the father is so moved by the situation the son's in, but he has a crisis. I won't give away the whole thing, but it has a hero's journey, a classic kind of story structure, and something very heroic happens in this video. Anyway, in 100 seconds, if you're not super stressed out or just not paying attention, this is going to grab you by the heartstrings. And for parents, it's terrible. I showed it to my class about a year ago. I don't know. I've seen this video 150 times at least. We studied it, I mean, using every method possible, from blood draws to fMRI. You have no idea. And we've used it in psychiatric populations. I mean, it's really a very consistent, the most consistent oxytocin stimulus. We shared it with many people, many scientists. Anyway, I gave it my class, and all of a sudden, I'm tearing up.
Wow.
I don't know. Maybe I was tired or I was missing my kids or something. And I'm like, okay, we got to take a 10-minute break. So it's pretty powerful.
Wow. And what percentage of people get an oxytocin raise from it?
We find about 90% of the people will get an increase in oxytocin.
This is so cool. So we're going to hack 90% of the audience at the Bulletproof Conference all at once in the first 10 minutes of the conference. All right, that's cool.
You're going to tell me what happens for sure. Take a video.
Well, there will be a video. Absolutely. I'll share it with you, Paul. I'm grateful that you're going to let me use the video. This is going to be so fun. Did I mention bulletproofconference.com? All right. If you weren't going to go, now you're going to.
Now I'm coming. I'll come to the first day at least.
Oh, no. You've got a pass. You've got a pass, Paul. No problem. Anytime.
I'm there.
Where are you based now?
I'm outside LA. So
We're in Pasadena. So it's just a quick drive for you.
Yeah. Easy.
Oh, that's so cool. All right, so we talked about individual decision making. We talked about how we can hack my oxytocin. I'm going to be more kind of in the zone. Now, let's say that I take my senior executive team at Bulletproof, and I sit everyone down. My next 2-hour all hands, or not all hands, but my next 2-hour call, I play the video at the beginning, and I say, "All right, guys, we're all going to watch this together. How is it going to change our group decision making after we watch it?"
I'm going to sort of disagree with the premise of the question. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You could do that, and for 20 minutes, people would probably be a little nicer to each other. They might be more open to sharing. The reason we started doing the work on organizational trust is because you can't show an emotional video every week. First of all, people acclimate to it right away, and you can't bring in, take the little bald cancer kid and walk him around your office. I mean, it's just not appropriate, right?
Of course, I hear you.
So we started thinking about. I'm like you, I'm a hacker, right? So how do I hack this brain system so that people at work are more effective? And from the neuroscience experiments we've run and from lots of other people, we put together a framework so that, first of all, you can measure trust and its 8 constituent factors. And for each of those factors, there are lots of interventions we've identified, most of whom people have tried. I read a zillion books and I stole from somewhere. I said, oh, that's going to juice this system. So let me give you a concrete example. So the 8 factors somehow magically, Dave, spell out oxytocin. I don't know how that happened.
Wow, but, randomness.
just the good luck of life. So the first O is for ovation. That's our word for recognizing people who meet or exceed their goals. So I say, okay, that's not new. That's just recognition. I would learn that the first day at the Wharton MBA. Except the neuroscience gives you specific and actionable ways to get the biggest bang for the buck on the brain and on behavior. So ovation that is close in time to the goal meeting being met, that is unexpected, that is public, that is tangible, that is personal, all that produces a bigger effect on the brain, both on oxytocin and the dopamine system. And now you're setting up a desire to be rewarded again in the future. So you're laying down pathways that say, in our organization, when we hit the ball out of the park, it's awesome. So how do I reinforce that? you got to do something that amps up. So we're going to go tandem skydiving with my team this week because we just finished this awesome 3-month project. People are like, holy crap, we can't do that. You know what? We're going to do it as a team. So I actually took my class tandem skydiving 1 year.
Nice.
Crazy. Yeah, and all of a sudden people are together. So like all brain systems, this stupid, lazy Republican brain that we got evolved in, there's no reason to make oxytocin unless I have a moderate stressor that motivates me to work together as a team. So as a team leader, you need to set expectations that are difficult but achievable. That brings the team together. And then when they reach those expectations, when you hit the goal, now take a day off, celebrate, bask in how great this is, and then reset, and a couple of days later, restart. So it's really this kind of, it's like working out. I'm going to push you hard. When you get there, I'm like, yes, great, let's go celebrate. And then recovery time, and then work out again.
Okay. That is, so that was the O in oxytocin. Oxytocin, and the X is expectation.
Expectation,
you dropped the E. What does expectation do?
It's really giving your brain an opportunity to make oxytocin as a team. So it's setting these goals that are concrete, difficult, and achievable. So as you know, stress is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Chronic stress is bad, but challenge stress where I have time-limited goals, I know when I'm done, your brain loves that. That's tandem skydiving. Actually, yeah, that's it's any sport you do. So setting up goals at work so that they're hard but achievable. Not always. Sometimes you want to have easy goals. That's okay. Sometimes we're just going to get this stuff done. But setting up challenges for individuals and then giving them lots of feedback on those challenges. So it's really seeing the leader as a coach, as a mentor, as a problem solver, as opposed to a dictator. So I really want to empower everyone on the team to be a decision maker, to innovate, to make mistakes. I love the we do a monthly congratulations, you screwed up celebration. So what was your biggest screw up this month? Yeah, let's talk about that. Because if you're not screwing up, you're not trying hard enough,
yes.
Right? So I'm loving the screw up. It's great. So it's that kind of thing. Like, we want you to innovate, and I want to use the knowledge of the crowd to get the best improvement in processes. Just because I sit in the chair in the corner office doesn't mean I have any more knowledge about anything than you guys who are doing this stuff every day and not thinking about finances and the next customer and growth and running a radio show and all these other kind of things. So I really want to empower all that on-the-ground knowledge so that we're really effective at what we're doing.
Yeah, setting expectations is really important. One of the things that new employees always find at Bulletproof, they'll come to me and say, what should we do? I'm like, here's the deal. I'm the CEO. I haven't studied the problem. You studied the problem. So why should I decide what to do? So I have this mantra. It's like, what do you think? Like, pretty much any time you ask me a question and you haven't already done the thinking yourself, I'm just kidding, what do you think? Right? And then I don't have to do the thinking because actually I'm paying other people to do the thinking, and that's the expectation that I'm setting. And then we can talk about it once they say what they think. Like, I don't know, we could do A or B. I think A is the right answer for these reasons. Great. I'm probably going to agree with you, or I'll say, now you don't know about these other reasons, let's do B. But if it's presented, I don't know, what should we do, A or B? Most people, I think, will generally pick one. Or say, they'll ask for all the information they need to make the decision, but I'm like actively repelling decision making unless I'm the only one who can make it. And that's part of the expectation that I set for my team. Is that effective, or am I like driving down oxytocin unwittingly?
No, it's very effective in a couple different ways. No, you're empowering other people, which is showing them trust, so you're driving their oxytocin up. And you're also not inducing the chronic stress of, as a leader, behaving like a dictator and forcing knowledge down to people, as opposed to, you have more than one person that works for you. Why not take all that knowledge and let it filter up to you? So I think that's the important part. Here's another hack, since we're talking about hacks. The last N in the oxytocin acronym is for natural. And this is about how you lead an organization. I can see you're a natural leader. So part of that is not only empowering the people around you, but being vulnerable. So when you said, I don't know what's best, you figure it out. You're saying, look, I may sit in the corner office. Actually, I don't even have an office. I got rid of the office. I want to move. I want to be constantly at everyone's desk. So anyway, I'm on the move constantly like you are. I want you to know that I don't know everything. And when you do that, you go, oh yeah, we're all on the same team, right? So we're all going to try to figure this out together. Again, you or I may know some things about the business that someone else doesn't. That's okay. but they may know a lot of things I don't. In fact, for sure they know a lot of things that I don't. So let's combine that knowledge set and see what the best decision is. And also take ownership of the mistakes. So there's something in psychology called the pratfall effect. So it turns out that people who are too perfect, too beautiful, too smart, we sort of hate them because they're not like us. They're like, freaks. I remember I was in New York once a couple of years ago, and I'm walking down Fifth Avenue after a meeting, and I'm looking around. I'm like, holy crap, these people are too beautiful. Like 6 foot tall model. And it's fashion week. I didn't know. I wasn't there for fashion week. And so all I see is like male and female models who are the most gorgeous, like genetic anomalies you've ever seen in your life. And then I'm like, oh gosh, now I hate them, right? It's not fair. Yeah, they're probably stupid. Who knows? But maybe they're not. That's the bad behavior.
Shades of Zoolander right there.
So anyway, but as a leader, if you make a mistake and own that mistake, a pratfall, and you're, as long as you're seen as competent, people actually like you more. So an example is John F. Kennedy, right after the Bay of Pigs invasion, which failed, went on TV and said, here's what happened. I got advice. I thought it was a good idea. I blew it. And I wasn't a very good leader. And I want to get better. And I'd like your support so I can learn how to be a better leader. And I'll certainly learn from this mistake. And after that, his approval ratings went up. Wow. Because he said, look, I'm doing my best. I thought this was a good idea. Turns out it was a very, very bad idea. So that little pratfall, that little imperfection is really actually attractive. So, yeah. I think it also takes the pressure off leaders, the work we're doing, which is if you empower the people around you, you don't have to be a demigod. You don't have to know everything. All you got to be doing is moving the business forward, do the best you can, listen a lot, and empower the people around you to make decisions and also make mistakes and not have blowback from it.
Yeah, we celebrate failure. Certainly that's part of the Bulletproof culture. And even when I put my kids to bed at night, I'm like, so what did you fail at today?
And they'll
find something, and I go, I don't think that was really a failure. Like, a failure is something that you really worked on doing that just didn't happen the way you wanted. And they're like scratching their little heads trying to find one. And the idea being, well, if you didn't get one of those, it wasn't a very good day. And I think they finally internalize that. I'll tell you when they're 25. But
right. You know, I same thing with my kids.
Sweet.
Applies. No, not exactly the mistake thing, but I just refuse to answer questions for them. Like when they were little, saying, why is the sky blue? How would you figure it out? What experiment would you run? What source would you go to? Because I can tell you and you won't remember it. But if you do it, it's experiential. So I think the same thing at work. I could tell you how to do something, or I could say, here's the training. Now, here's this new task slightly outside your training. Give it a shot. And as long as no one's going to get hurt or injured or something, I think that's a great way to learn. And then it becomes your. You own this thing now that you figured out. And the important part is, during ovations, to share that with the rest of the team. So here's a concrete but stupid example from my lab. So when we started, we do a lot of blood work. So we take blood. I designed a system. We have a phlebotomist. We have a divider, blah, blah, blah. Now my lab's so big that I'm not at every experiment. I may design them, but I'm not there. So anyway, I come back from some trip, and the blood room is completely rearranged. And now instead of one chair and a divider, there's two chairs and a divider. And there's two sets of blood draw kits on each side. I said, okay, what happened here? What's the deal? And they're like, oh, we realized that we wasted a lot of time when the person who got their blood draw, the next person sits in the chair, someone has to pull up the sleeve, they got to put on the tourniquet, it's really slow. So we have like a prep person, and the phlebotomist just goes from chair to chair. Brilliant! Why didn't I think of that, right? Because we were never doing high volume when I set up this system. Yes, innovate. I love it. We always do that now. It was like whoever, I forget now in my lab, who had that idea. Yes. Let's not waste time. I want that chair to be hot. Get the people in and out. Do the blood draws fast.
So can people send blood to your labs to get oxytocin tests now, or is it just for university research?
That's a good question. So oxytocin has this double life, like many other neurochemicals, serotonin, dopamine. So the reason there's no blood test for low serotonin in the brain, which may or may not be associated with depression, is because serotonin is the major gut neurotransmitter. And 99% of what's in your body is in your gut. So if I give you a blood test for serotonin, I can measure it, but I'm going to get what's in your gut. That's why people who take SSRI sometimes will get things like diarrhea, because you're speeding up the gut motility. Mm. Okay, so oxytocin binds to the peripheral nervous system, to the breast to facilitate milk flow, to the uterus to contract during birth. That's the hormonal effects. But it's made in the brain, and in the brain it's functioning as a neuromodulator. That is, it changes the activity of networks of brain cells. So basal levels of oxytocin in blood are unrelated to levels in the brain.
Okay.
But if I stimulate it, like using a little video, if I stimulate the brain to make oxytocin, the change in blood reflects the change in brain. Excuse me. So that's the secret to our success, which is there are basically two neurochemicals in which if you stimulate it, blood reflects the change of blood reflects the change of brain, and oxytocin is one of those two. Wasn't that a lucky call? I mean, just happened to be this very ancient molecule. So the blood test would tell you only about what's in your peripheral nervous system. Now we do find that for people with psychiatric disorders, that they have highly dysregulated oxytocin levels due to receptor problems. You can sometimes see that in blood. Often you can see it in blood. People with schizophrenia, social anxiety, sometimes depression will see dysregulated oxytocin. So in fact, very high levels of oxytocin at baseline. All these neurochemicals work on feedback loops. So I make some, it binds the receptor, it turns off the production. So if the production is not being turned off, you have very high levels, there's potentially a receptor dysfunction. There could be other factors, Dave. I don't want to diagnose people here. But anyway, we find it consistently. We certainly find it in the psychopaths, so really regulated oxytocin. So the thing that we developed is an oxytocin stimulation test. We can use the video, which is a very effective way to do it. I look at change. If the change is within a certain range, then your system is working properly. If it's not, then either having a bad day, we should retest, or there may be some dysfunction. And the system is plastic, so it evolves even as adults. You met me when I was a nice person, but I used to be you talked about testosterone in the opener, such a high testosterone, only by the numbers, I don't care what you think kind of person. And I got a lot done, but I think I didn't have really good social skills. And I've worked very hard, as you know, to be a better connector, to be more empathic, to be warmer. And there's good evidence in animals that, as you become more engaged with humans, particularly the number of oxytocin receptors will increase, and you'll become a more empathic person. So how about that? And kids do it, actually. So you have little kids. Are these your first kids?
The 6 and 9, yeah.
6 and 9, yeah. So you know when you had that little 9-year-old when it was a baby, that all of a sudden, like, things outside that family life are less important.
Yeah.
I became a much more patient person with my kids. Your oxytocin is getting spiked a lot. Your testosterone goes down when you have kids. So, you're kind of changing the balance in your life, which I think is, for men in particular, is actually very important because our testosterone is so through the roof high that we can be assholes. Let's be honest.
I definitely used to be a pretty big jerk, and I definitely didn't have an easy time with social connectedness either. Some recent study I just posted on Facebook too talked about changes in genetic expression from feelings of loneliness, like stuff that
right.
I never knew that. But wow, inflammation happens when you're feeling lonely. Like, who would have expected that?
And I think we can thought. I mean, I love that your whole goal in life is to be a biohacker. Maybe not your whole goal in life, but one of your
one
big
of them,
focuses. I think I've tried to do the same thing at least with this
very
connection
much.
System.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think we can thoughtfully say, I need to build better relationships. I need to invest time in those relationships. I know you're certainly doing it. I'm trying hard. And I'll show you the payoff. I went from being, jock, too high. I have way too much energy for normal humans. And anyway, I turned 50 recently. I had 4 people throw me surprise birthday parties.
Wow.
Who knew, right? So, I mean, I think that's a sign that I'm just getting better at those social relationships. So, yeah, that could be a goal.
Yeah, I've had one surprise birthday party when I turned 40, and it completely blew me away. I'd never expected or had anything like that because I'd never been. I used to have like Asperger's syndrome level of connection issues, and huge difference to have that kind of community. It's pretty amazing. What about oxytocin and light? Like, you can turn on neurotransmitters. I've used low level light therapy on my brain to turn on all sorts of interesting things. The color of light we're exposed to, sunshine, ultraviolet light, infrared light, different colors. I have, going back 10 years ago, I got like these set of lenses that change your transmitter, like your neurotransmitter levels based on lavender and yellow and different colors.
Wow.
Have you looked into any of that?
I haven't, and I don't even know this literature, so I would love to do some tests. I think offline, we could hypothesize a little bit, and it's easy enough to do.
Yeah.
Here's the big technological breakthrough: is we now have developed a technology to measure oxytocin binding in the vagus nerve and the heart using wireless sensors. So now I don't need to stick a needle into you anymore. And so the testing for oxytocin and its impacts is much faster, cheaper, and actually much higher frequency. I can measure 1,000 times a second using the medical grade sensors we have. So I can really get very rich information second by second on how you're responding to a stimuli. And we do a lot of work in neuromarketing now because of this. So I can diagnose a communication or an ad and say, here's where you grab them emotionally. They can't even tell you that. But in second 13, when the little boy shows up, that's when you start getting emotionally engaged in this ad. And that's why you capture people's hearts and minds.
Wow. I'm working on the new 40 Years of Zen program. This is a neurofeedback-based 5-day, super intense, like upgrade every system you can. I spent 10 weeks of my life with electrodes glued to my head, like just developing self-awareness. And it's changed who I am and what I'm capable of. And I've done it with high-end clients for a while. And we're doing a second rev of the technology that's much more advanced than it used to be, with heart rate variability as part of it and all. But I'm really intrigued by the thoughts of wireless sensors for this. Are these the kind of things that are going to reach consumer grade? Like, I have $99 heart rate sensors that I sell on Bulletproof. And I see them used. I recommend people use those to basically improve meditation, because when you're meditating wrong, your heart rate variability changes. Can I get one of these? Or do you see a day in 5 years where people will be able to get one of these heart rate sensors and actually meditate to raise oxytocin? And when it's not raising, you see results on your iPhone and it tells you, like, meditate better, dumbass?
Which always helps when you're meditating, right? You stupid person.
You're meditating wrong. Bad. Is that actually possible with this kind of tech? Like I'm blown away.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I got to come up and visit you
anytime.
Now. So that's exactly what we're doing this summer. Is we have a device, we've built the algorithms, we've got an alpha test going on right now, so that we can have a wearable that has high enough grade data where we actually can measure not only oxytocin, but really engagement more broadly understood. So part of the engagement is I have to pay attention to you, right? And the second is I have to sort of care about what you're saying. I have to listen well. I have to respond to you. So we built algorithms, an algorithm we call Zest, that tells us about the quality of that relationship. That's a whole other hour.
People listening, some of them are really seriously into biohacking. Like, this conversation should be blowing you away. I feel like this is where the world is going. Like this is so cool. All right, question for you then. I have a good friend, Joe Polish, who runs the Genius Network. And this is a group of like high-end marketing people, and he's helped like many, many people, like Richard Branson and Tim Ferriss and guys like that succeed. And he's working on addiction, and he's been looking really hard for a system that can tell you when an addict is about to go back to their habit, whatever their habit is, a sex addict, drug addict, alcoholic, whatever. Is oxytocin a part of the addiction cycle that we experience, or is that all dopamine?
Yeah, it's a great question. We actually have done some studies on this, and other labs have as well. So the question that sort of drove me was, if you're in rehab, if you're an addict and you're getting treated, what you often see is that people who have been addicted for a long period of time don't draw on their social support network to really stay sober. AA. Forget about all the, you know, making amends and all that. Part of it's just a support network to say, yeah, I realize I have a problem, and I want to have these people help me, you know, deal with that problem. And it can be very effective. So we find in long-term stimulant use, methamphetamine, cocaine, is that the receptors for oxytocin that make it feel good to interact with other people, particularly in the frontal cortex, are damaged or killed. Oh. So a reason why we're, you know, long-term addicts, particularly stimulant addicts, don't reach out, I think, is they just don't have the neural resources. They're not motivated. They don't get that kind of kick that we do when we meet someone new. We see a good friend. We get a hug. There's been some very recent clinical trials using oxytocin to ease some of the symptoms, withdrawal symptoms from coming off drugs, with some reasonably promising results. Oxytocin works as an analgesic. So one reason that I'm comfortable around strangers when my brain makes oxytocin is because my physiologic arousal reduces. And also my pain level, activation in the brain's pain matrix goes down. So it literally feels comfortable to be around you. Isn't that weird? So again, this is this kludgy evolutionary system. So your question, I think, is a great one, which is, could I have a sensor that would say, you're at risk now for, I'm not sure. I mean, I think with enough research and some smart algorithms, it might be possible.
Well, here's the deal. There's $1 million for you if it's possible, because Joe just put up $1 million as an award, like an XPRIZE level award, for being able to predict a relapse for addicts. So that the reason I was asking, it sounds like your tech with the sensor on the heart, fascinating stuff. And I hope everyone listening is as intrigued by this idea and this thinking as I am, because this is just cool stuff. And if you're not intrigued, sorry, go to the next episode, because this is awesome. Right.
Because aren't we fascinated? I think we're fascinated by two things. One is ourself. Like, I've MRI'd my brain a zillion times, and then my wife's. So I have my wife's brain and my brain, and I spent 5-6 minutes looking at my wife's brain, looking for tumors. I understand why she's so crazy. And my brain, I've spent hours looking at my own brain. Like, oh, yeah. My God, my amygdala is so weird shaped, right? Okay. So I think we're interested in that. And then we're interested in other people. Like, why are the people around us so weirdly interesting and sometimes crazy? Like, that is a fascinating topic for social creatures. And the sensors give us objective information that's not being filtered through our own bullshit. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great way to figure out, hey, you know what? My wife is really stressed out today. Instead of me bitching back at her, what she really needs is a hug or just 20 minutes alone to decompress or whatever.
Or a 100-second video. Like, honey, watch this. I'll be right back.
It'd be great. Yeah. It takes all the pressure off me then, right? I don't have to do any caretaking. I just, watch the video. You'll be good.
All right. So there's an ethical question here for you, Paul. I mean, is it ethical to hack your employees this way or hack your wife this way?
So I gave a talk recently, and I said I want to use at a university. And you know, everyone's so sensitive now, microaggressions. I said I have to use one bad word in this talk, and I want to give you a chance to either leave or close your ears.
A trigger warning that you're going to say poop, yeah, right?
That's right. And it starts with a P. That's right. I have to use one word, starts with a P, and that word is persuasion. And I want to try to convince you in the next hour that persuasion is not a dirty word, because every time I interact with any human being, I am seeking to persuade him or her, at least unconsciously. Right, Dave? I'd like you to like me. I don't know why, but I have some interest. Actually, we have a lot of stuff we got to talk about now.
Totally.
We have a ton of stuff to do together. So every interaction involves persuasion. Whether you like it or not, whether you're thinking about it or not, you're still doing it. So if we understand neurologically how to persuade people, which is about 10 years of work out of my lab, then we can be more effective at it. And oxytocin is part of that. It's not the whole answer. So I think if you're transparent about it, I want to make the best case possible to you about, say, purchasing my new product. You have a big brain, a nice big prefrontal cortex. I'd rather make the case better than make it worse. I'd rather show you why it's great for you. So sure, it's going to generate a sale for me, but you know, I'd like to have you as a long-term customer. So I want to make the most persuasive case possible. In the end, you have to decide. I can't coerce you. I'm not going to hold a gun to your head. So if we're going to persuade people anyway, why don't we just try to do it really well? And as long as we're transparent about it, like when we do micro-learning, before you do any micro-learning with your employees on improving culture, have a town hall and sit down and talk about what we're doing. So yeah, we're doing this because we think it'll be better for you. You'll be more engaged with your work, more engaged with the people around you, and we're going to be more productive and make more profit so you can keep your job and even get a raise. So if you guys are okay with that, let's try it for 30 days and just see what happens. If it sucks or you hate it, let me know. The last thing I want to do is drive you guys crazy because I hired you because I think you guys are awesome. So as long as you say that and then give constant feedback, look, if this is not working or you're tired of doing these surveys every month or whatever, let me know. We can change it.
It feels like you're saying every time you interact with someone, you're hacking them on some level. Like either you're adding value or you're not. And I made that decision with Bulletproof Radio. I look at the number of downloads and the number of hours, and it's, let's see, we're probably running around 42 million downloads of the show now. So 42 million hours of human lifetime. Like, okay, I'm either a mass murderer if I'm wasting people's time, like hundreds of lifetimes, or like I'm adding value. But at the end of the day, I'm somewhere on that spectrum. I'm probably not right in the middle. right? So I'm actively hacking people listening to this right now. Like the words we're choosing, whether they're conscious or unconscious, have an effect on the people around them. The way you're moving, the way I'm moving, all of this is taken in by other people's nervous systems as an environmental signal, and it's going to do something to them. Right. I figure that that's happening, whether it's all unconscious or all conscious. It should just be all conscious so that we can actually do better things. The reason I asked about the ethics of this is that I also just unveiled a program at Bulletproof. I'm hacking all of the employees' brains, where I took the neuroscientist from 40 years of Zen, and we have dedicated clinical grade EEG at the office for all the employees so that they can do high-end clinical grade neurofeedback to improve themselves.
Right.
And it's like, it's a giant investment, like personally, just in terms of monetary investment, but it's like a cultural thing. But there's also like, is it ethical to hack your employees' brains? And I thought about this for a long time, and I said, well, is it ethical for me not to? Like if it works and it's available and I could do it, then how could I not? Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a lot written about this over the next 10 years about this idea.
I love it. I agree with you completely. As long as there's an opt-out, you're not forcing them to do this. Saying, look, this is available. We think it's going to be good for you. It's probably good for the company too, but also I want this to be a great place for you to work.
Yeah, and like you get to keep the improvements in brain no matter where you go after this. Like it's your brain and like it just got a tuning. And it's going to make you nicer to the people around you, but you wanted that anyway, and it's now everything's easier, and it's profoundly changed who I am. So that said, though, I'm sure there's going to be a few people, even at Bulletproof, although we tend to hire biohackers in general, but a few people like, I might not like what I might find. I'm like, so then don't do it. Like, it's totally cool, but I think I'm going to see just about everyone in the company raise their hand and say, of course I want to try this.
And at least try it.
Yeah, we'll see what happens, right?
Yeah, you can always stop doing it. I remember... a couple of years ago, Time Magazine asked me to kind of write a little blurb for New Year goals or something. Like, what, you know, how do you know you're having an impact on people? And I thought, you know, what I'm trying to do in my life is what I call create a love plus environment. So for every interaction, I want to add a little more love to the world.
Nice. Right?
So if I can do that, if I can improve the people's lives or maybe just a little bit by some effort that I can take, then I've had a positive impact. And if that spreads, hey, great. If it doesn't, then I've just tried to make someone around me nicer or happier.
That is such an elegant way of putting it, love plus. And it's not like you have to do a big thing. It's just if you had two paths and one of them had more love in it, or you just take that, it didn't cost you anymore to take that.
No.
And it's the same philosophy behind biohacking. Like I believe when you make yourself a little bit better every day, you're nicer to everyone around you.
Right? Because your stress is lower. Yeah. You're eternally happier, you're flourishing. Absolutely. And we know that, right? And so here's the last thing on oxytocin, and I promise I'll take a breath. When we're under very high stress, we're in survival mode. Epinephrine inhibits the release of oxytocin. So now all of a sudden, it's about me trying to get through the next 10 minutes that I can't even be nice to you, right? We've all been in that state, and it's not pleasant. So, you know, a little stress, good for oxytocin release, good for teamwork, good to bring us together. Too much stress, not good. So kind of finding that balance, I think, in our own lives is very important, where we, you know, sometimes we are whipped out, and sometimes that's appropriate. But I think as you get older, you learn to modulate that, and things like meditation, biofeedback, all that are great ways to learn how to modulate your own response to stress. Because stress is just a cortical fantasy anyway, right? As long as you're not being, you know, hit or stabbed or something, that's a physiologic stressor. But we think about, oh my God, can I pay the mortgage next month? That's not going to actually kill you in the next 10 minutes. So, you know, I mean, that's a stressor and you have to resolve that problem. But we can just learn to like, okay, I'm going to take a breath. I'm going to meditate, or I'll take a walk, or whatever it is. Or draw on the people around me and say, you know what, honey? I'm just having a bad day. I just need to have a little extra time and care from you. And I've gotten to the age of my life where I don't mind asking that of my friends and family. And you know what? I could use a little extra love right now. How about someone help me out?
Yeah, being able to ask for help is not a natural male thing to do, but it's really beneficial when you learn that it's safe to do that. I never was wired to do that either. You mentioned epinephrine. Do you track the epinephrine to norepinephrine ratio in the work you do?
You know, we have. We found that since we've now moved to sensors, that heart rate and skin conductance are actually pretty good measures. We used to go through 12 to 13 7-gallon biohazard buckets
of
needles and tubes and blood draw material. And we're probably down to maybe 4 of those 7-gallon buckets per year now. So we've really cut down by half or more the amount of blood work we do, because we've correlated those blood findings with these high-frequency, non-invasive measures. And as you're right, once we get down to wearable sensors, our whole world is getting better, right?
It's such valuable work you've done, Paul. And for people listening, you got to understand, Paul's been drawing huge amounts of blood and looking at chemicals and realizing, oh, wait, there's a signal coming off the body that was always there that's easy to get. We just didn't know this signal matched these chemicals. So right. like that is game-changing for all of us, because it's cheap and easy to get an electrical or even an electromagnetic signal off the body. And even a movement, a gait, there's all these things we radiate all the time, all this information that's been ignored by most of medical science, except for some neurological things here and there. But when you put that together and you draw the correlations there, we shouldn't be drawing as much blood as we are. That said, I just had 20 vials drawn 2 weeks
ago.
Oh,
no.
No, that's good. I do blood tests for fun, right? I mean,
okay, no sickness.
No. This was for the Human Longevity Inc. We did the full human genome sequencing, and 3 or 4 times a year, I get 19 or 20 vials drawn just because I'm tracking stuff. I'm going to live to 180. I want to know everything I can.
There you go. There you go. Well, you know what we might do at the conference in Pasadena is we could certainly test the sensors you have, but we could actually play the video and hook some people up in real time to the sensors, show the data on the screen.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. In fact, hook me up and we'll hook up a couple other people. Okay.
So just make sure you don't see the video, although it's hard to acclimate to it. This stuff's like deep in the brainstem, so it's hard to suppress.
All right. We'll do me and we'll do a couple of victims from the audience. Okay. So yeah, we'll arrange this offline. This is going to be so fun. If you're listening to this and you were in LA or you're going to be in LA in September, you have to come to the conference. It's going to be so amazing. Bulletproofconference.com. Paul, how fun. We'll do this probably we'll figure out which day it works, but probably the opening day.
Excellent.
Wow. All right. I have one more question for you before we come to the end of the interview. And if someone came to you today and said, Paul, I want to kick more ass at everything I do in life. Like, given everything you've learned in your life, what are the 3 most important things I need to do? Things I need to know in order to achieve that goal? I want to be better at everything. What matters most?
Gosh, what a great question. You couldn't have prepped me for this?
I mean, if you listened to any of the past episodes, you would have known it was coming. I mean,
number one would be caffeine, of course. We know that.
Best answer ever in 3.
Maybe bulletproof coffee, I'm just saying. I think that the first thing is, take risk, take smart risk for sure. The second is ask for help all the time. Don't believe your own BS, really ask for help. And the second is believe in yourself. I think, you and I are both, we're doing things we never should have been doing. We weren't trained to do. And part of that was just being kind of a stubborn, I'm just going to play this thing out. I don't want to be stupid, but just let it play out and just see if you can accumulate evidence that this might not be crazy. The oxytocin stuff was off the reservation crazy.
Yeah.
If I knew now, whatever I didn't know back then, I would never have done it. I mean, it was way too hard. It was way too risky. But I had this intuition, and I just accumulated evidence little by little by little. I asked for so many people's help. I just said, I don't know anything. You work with rats. In fact, I was so lazy, Dave. I said, hey, you're a rat oxytocin guy. Here, I'll design an experiment for humans and you. I figured out a great protocol. I think it'll work. Why don't you guys do it? You're the experts. And literally, a couple people said to me, like, humans, they don't have fur, they don't have tails. Like, I don't know how to get involved in that kind of species. So finally, out of desperation, I'm like, okay, if this is such a good idea, I got to figure out how to do it. So I got to learn how to draw blood. I got a phlebotomy license. I hired MDs. I did all the things I had to do to make this legit. And anyway.
Wow. Well, I'm impressed. And I haven't talked about this on Bulletproof Radio before, but we're opening the first bulletproof human hacking lab in Santa Monica, and it's got a lot of stuff that it creates interventions for increasing mitochondrial function and things like that. And part of it is a partnership with a lab that has a phlebotomist, IV therapies, and all that. And the goal there is to be able to offer any blood test you want. There's a whole firewall around getting blood tests, and I feel like it's a fundamental human right to know anything about your body that can be known. So we're enabling that, and I hope to beat your record of 7 buckets of biohazard material.
When's the lab open in Santa Monica?
As soon as we get our building permit stuff in order. So it'll be within the next month or two, is a good guess.
I'll be there for the grand opening. You can count on it.
You're on the list.
That sounds great. This has been so much fun. I can't tell you.
Oh, it's been great fun. Now, where can people find out more about your work, Dr. Love?
PaulJZak.com.
Z-A-K.
Z-A-K. OFactor.com on organizational trust and optimizing teamwork. And our work on really the biohacking and stuff is at ZestXLabs.com. ZestXLabs.com. So like all of us, you know, we're doing 14 things at once.
Sure.
By the way, we take tax money from you know, nice taxpayers in the U.S. So we love to have people come visit our lab at Claremont Graduate University. So people can find me online, shoot me an email if you're in the L.A. area and you'd like to see what we do. Everyone's welcome.
Beautiful. That's a huge offer. I suspect you'll get some people taking you up on that. There's an amazing community of people listening to Bulletproof Radio. The kind of people who come to the conference and come to the coffee shop in Santa Monica and just hang out. And actually, now the one downtown, we just opened our second one in the Arts District. And so just people who really will, because they're deeply curious about this stuff. So I suspect you'll have a couple cool lunches as a result of that offer. So people, take Paul up on this. Paul, thanks for being on Bulletproof Radio. I'm so excited to be hacking people using your tech at the conference. It's going to be great fun. And have an awesome time, and I'll see you in another month or so at the conference, September 23rd through 25th.
Thanks so much for having me on. I look forward to many conversations with you in the future.
Likewise. And I forgot the final thing. Your new book that's coming out, I said its name earlier. It's going to be called, what's it called?
Trust Factor.
Trust Factor. And where can people find out more about that? Is there a way to pre-order it or anything yet, or not yet?
It's on Amazon. Trust Factor on Amazon.
Oh, so go to Amazon and do Trust Factor. So if you enjoyed this interview as much as I did, this is one of those really fun ones where you learn a lot of stuff and you talk to a world expert in something, go out there and pick up a copy, or I'd say pre-order a copy of Paul's book. Go to Amazon right now and just search for Trust Factor. It's called The Science of Creating High-Performance Companies. His name is Paul Zak, Z-A-K. So order that, and I can tell you, I'll be reading an early copy of that before you get yours, because Paul's probably going to send me the PDF right after this. At least when he's done editing it. And I'll be rolling this stuff out at Bulletproof before you even get the book, but when you get the book, you'll be ahead of the curve.
Thanks for the plug. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for watching. Get tons more original info to make it easier to kick more ass at life when you sign up with a free newsletter at bulletproofexec.com. Thanks for watching, and stay bulletproof.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem, or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.